So Jerry, you're going to be Mary.
I'm coaching Mary, or
I'm... No, we're going to talk about this together.
Okay.
And you're going to be the person in you're You're Mary Smith.
Okay.
Okay. So Mary, what are the issues in this case that you see?
Okay, and you are?
I'm a recruiter. I'm interviewing you for a job as HR, and I've given you this case, and now I'm asking you to assume the role in the case of Mary.
Okay.
And I want to get a sense of how you think.
Okay.
So tell me what do you think of this case? What are the issues here?
Okay. Well, we have several issues, some of which are a bit at conflict with one another. We always try to do the right thing at Hallandale Beach, and my employer is responsive to the needs of the community and wanting to provide the best service possible for the safety of those that use our beach. Recently we had an event where one of our employees acted upon himself to do what he felt was the right thing, and that was to save lives, which is important.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a policy in play that we've reinforced through orientation, our employee handbook, and our company policy, that for the safety and well-being of those that we serve at the beach, we do not allow our guards to provide outside services to the neighboring beach without prior permission. Unfortunately, when there's an act of emergency or urgency, sometimes people act on their own free will.
Right.
And we had a recent situation where an individual acted upon his own free will, left his post, and, you know, in the end, the person that was in jeopardy at the accompanying beach was rescued, so to speak, mm-hmm. by another individual. So, fait accompli, the person really didn't need to leave his post.
Mm-hmm.
So we gave him a warning, because that was in alignment with mm-hmm. our policies and procedures, and is what we are holding our employees accountable to.
Okay.
So,
and now, what would you recommend we do at this point? Because Thomas has said, you give me the warning, that's fine, but I'm gonna do it again, because I'm a lifeguard. Lifeguards save lives. So, give me the warning, but I'm gonna do it again. Now, what are you gonna do?
You know, I'm gonna talk with our owner, and check with our liability insurance.
Okay.
To determine whether there is a humanitarian clause in that free waterways generally do not restrict boats or people from swimming from one area to the next, or there's no trespassing clause that I can see, but it may be important for us to revisit this to determine whether or not Thomas or any other employee would need additional coaching or training to understand what are the parameters and the reasons for them. Or if we need to modify because of, like, doctors, you know, have the right to serve
mm-hmm.
or to
right.
protect the urgency of a situation in the moment, regardless of whether or not that person is their patient. I don't know exactly what that clause is called, but it might be something to take a look at.
Okay.
I'm not that familiar with it myself personally, but it would be something to.
Well, now I'm going to assume now that I'm going to tape record this conversation, and I want you to be Mary, and I'm going to be Thomas.
Okay.
So, I want you to tell me what you're planning to do to me.
Okay.
Because you are the HR person, you.
Right.
So,
okay.
So ready? I'm going to turn the tape recorder on.
Okay, great.
Is Mary the HR person?
In this, well, she is now.
Okay. I am now. Okay.
So,
Thomas, I'd like you to come on into my office and let's sit down and have a good conversation.
Okay.
I heard recently, yesterday, I'll assume it was yesterday, that there was a situation that you responded to on your
mm-hmm. I did.
And I thank you for your spirit and goodwill. I understand that you acted upon your own consideration for saving other lives, which is commendable. My concern is that having reviewed our conditions of employment and your signing of our employee handbook mm-hmm. and understanding that there's liability involved on part of the municipality as well as our organization and our practices. So can you tell me, was there any reason why you didn't call 911 first and foremost? Because that is, I believe, the first step.
That's what the policy says. That was what the training said.
Did you go through the training?
Yeah, I was aware. But this is Hallandale. Yeah. You know, some guy's drowning. I'm going to call 911, wait for the police to show up when I could save that guy. I'm trained to do that.
And who would replace you for the Hallandale individuals that may be swimming and drowning?
Well, I'm not going to be gone for that long. So.
You have no way of knowing that, do we?
No.
So what happens is that when you respond to another need outside our ability to manage and to provide good service and security, you're putting our customers at risk, which is why you were hired, was to protect those that were serving at the Hallandale Beach. Do you understand?
I understand that.
Good.
I agree with you.
Good.
But I'm a lifeguard.
Exactly. You know,
and lifeguards save lives. And how do you expect me, if I see somebody who's drowning,
and
to...
And doctors save lives, too.
Yeah.
Right? So if you were in a hospital, or you were in a car accident, or you were at the airport, and you saw someone, you'd want to help them.
Yeah.
And that's why we hired you, because you're that type of person. You're mm-hmm. you're a helper. Mm-hmm. You're a doer. So my object of talking with you today is not to make you feel bad. It's just to try to work out what is fair and reasonable to serving our customers and making sure that we have appropriate coverage across the board.
Okay. Let me stop you at this point, okay?
Sure.
Boy, I'd love to hire you. let me explain.
Let's talk.
She's good. She's... Most HR people, when I give the case, they say exactly what you said, and then when I show the tape recorder, mm-hmm. and then I say I'm going to turn it on, and then I play Thomas, I don't necessarily get the same. What usually happens is, the rules are the rules. You violated the policy. You've said you've continued to violate. I'm reluctant to do this, but I have no choice. You're fired. Even though they've just told me before that they wouldn't do that. But once the tape recorder's on, it's different. Now, why is that the case? I studied under a guy named Chris Argyris.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. And so you know where I'm going with this. This is a relatively modern PC, and it has Microsoft Office. And because of the way it's designed in Windows, you can be in Windows, and you make a spell check, and it will automatically make the same correction in Microsoft Excel spreadsheet, because all these systems are talking to each other. But you're too young to remember this, but there used to be a computer called the 386.
Oh, I had one.
And it looked just like this. You probably remember that. And it had MS-DOS, and it had a hard drive. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
But the way it was designed was, if you were in Windows, you were in Windows. And if you made a change in Windows, you made a change in Microsoft Word. That's it. It didn't have anything to do with Excel. And as a matter of fact, it was so designed such a way that if you wanted to get into Microsoft Excel, you had to get out of Microsoft Windows. Remember that? Mm-hmm. So Archer says, suppose the brain is designed like a clunky 386 machine. And there's a piece of your brain that has what Chris Argyris calls the espouse theory. These are what guide me. These are my values. These are what I really believe. I'm trustworthy, loyal, kind, brave, thrifty, clean, reverent. And if you put bring somebody with a lie detector test, I will pass because I really, really believe that. I'm fair and I have an open door policy. I treat people with respect. I really do. Now, I have another theory in my brain that may be physically right next to each other, just like Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel might be right next to each other on the hard drive. And this is what I actually do. This is the theory in use. It may not, and the one may have nothing to do with the other. So what happens is, one of the reasons why job interviews are such poor predictors of later performance is because the job interview is all espoused. This is what I believe. Tell me about yourself. I'm trustworthy, loyal, kind, brave, thrifty, clean, reverent. I have an open door policy. I'm firm and fair. I treat people with respect. I really do. And you believe me. And I believe me. But if I give a case, I remember the first part was I said, what do you think? And then I showed Jerry the tape recorder and I said, in a job interview, I would say, I'm going to show this to the hiring authority. We're going to compare your approach to the others. And I would go, bang. So the idea is you show a tape recorder, you say now it's for real. You're going to be recorded. You go bang and bang. According to Argyris, you now move from the espouse theory to the theory in use. Now what happened with Jerry is that she stayed consistent. She wouldn't fire Thomas. Most people who go through this exercise would. And
so glad. Yeah, that's great.
What do you teach, OB? Oh my God! I picked the wrong person. Next time, Will.
Okay.
So, one of the things that Jerry did, and again, Jerry teaches OB, so I think she has an unfair advantage. She
I'm a practitioner.
I know.
I'm in the field. I know.
One of the things that I find with HR and when their focus is on problems and solving problems, and most line managers say, if you wake them up at 3 a.m. and say, what are your greatest skills? Oh, I'm a problem solver. I can really solve problems. The issue is, the things that will destroy your companies are not problems, because problems have a solution. The things that will destroy your company, the things that will destroy this country, are dilemmas. The difference between a problem and a dilemma is, on one hand, the dilemma is, if you do this, these terrible things will happen. You don't want to do that. If you do that, these terrible things will happen. You don't want to do that. In the Middle East, we don't want Iran to build a nuclear war capability because that's going to unstabilize a very unstable situation. That's unacceptable. On the other hand, to stop Iran from developing nuclear capability means we bomb Iran and go to war with Iran. Do we really want to do that? I don't think America's ready for another war. So when you have two or more options and all of them suck, That's a dilemma. When you have a situation where there is a right answer, that's a problem. Most of your CEOs that you work for are problem solvers. And they often don't recognize when there's a dilemma. And if you want to go from being an HR Twinkie to a valued advisor to a CEO, then the first thing is to sort of be the first to recognize when a problem is not the problem, but it's a dilemma. And dilemma is, if we do this, this is bad, and if we do that, this is bad. Because often your bosses won't recognize, they will think it's a problem. And that's a dilemma. So again, if you want to upgrade your value in HR, one is to be a dilemma recognizer. Because you're in a very good position because you span different functions within your organization.
So what do you do if it's a dilemma? How do you, if your business has a dilemma and has no real solution, then what is there any way to deal with it? Other than just push it aside and not deal with it?
Well, often the issue with a dilemma is it has to be managed and it can't be solved.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, Jerry was brilliant because most HR people would say, well, the problem is a guy is willfully violating the policy. I regret having to do it, but we're going to have to fire him. Problem solved. But a dilemma. Jerry's trying to manage the dilemma by just, you know, let's get other people involved. Let's look at the issues. So sometimes you don't solve it. You just try to move it along.
But in this situation, if you did fire that person, I mean, there could be a public relations. Situation here too.
Yes.
Person in this day and age where there's social media. I got fired because, you know,
well,
I tried to save a life and blah blah blah, and next thing you know, you're
bingo. And again, one of the things that you've just done is you've recognized that this is an open system rather than a closed system. Mm-hmm. And one of your values to your bank is to keep reinforcing that this is an open system, not a closed system. Let me show you what actually happened in this case, because it's a real case. In the case, the person, Thomas, was fired. And as a result of him being fired, three of the lifeguards walked. Thomas, this is Thomas, the lifeguard. He was presented with the keys to the city of Hallandale for trying to save a Hallandale citizen. The company that hired him tried to hire him back. He said, no way. The beach company that fired Thomas lost its contract with Hallandale Beach. It was a three-year contract. Worth $3 million. The supervisor lost her job. Fire lifeguard is a hero. The Jeff Ellis company was the one that managed the beach. Now has a reputation on the internet for this is the company that fired a lifeguard for trying to save a life. Exactly what you're saying. Why? And this gets into the changing nature of power. When HR started, let's remember the history of HR. First HR was China. China. The emperor, typical of emperors and kings, the people helping make decisions, doing the ministry, were members of the royalty, family connections. The emperor wanted to change that. So China was the first to institute civil service exams for government jobs. That you had to compete for these. And actually, to this day, in China, the most prestigious thing is to work for the government, not business. Now, What happened in the late 19th century and then the beginning of the 20th century is the United States is moving from an agricultural economy into an industrial economy. And so a lot of people who were trained on farms didn't have any work ethic. You know, they were used to living in villages where, you know, I do things because my father told me to do it, or the priest told me to do that, or this is the tradition in our family, or you just do it because you're family. And they were moving into cities where you're being asked to do things by somebody who's not a member of your family, is not a member of your tribe, somebody you don't even know, and you have to obey them. That's kind of hard to do. Think about Afghanistan. And so HR kind of was part of that solution to help socialize an agricultural group into an industrial world, and was going to do it by systems and procedures that would not be personal, would be objective, and be standardized and applied to everybody else. And so particularly after World War II, when America was growing, particularly on the industrial side, that's the heyday for HR. So this was what HR value was. Consistency, systems, and standardization. And this was what HR value was. You still see this today, right? Attract, retain, motivate employees. And this belongs in the HR museum, because the world has changed, but HR hasn't. Because of all of these things, consistency, systems, standardization, basically, let's cut out the individual decisions, make it standardized, reduce costs. Who's this kind of like? Well, this is the CFO. And the CFO's job is reducing risk. So a lot of what HR tended to do, the CFO would say, well, that's what I do. And so in a lot of companies, HR, instead of reporting to the CEO, started reporting to the CFO. How many of you know an HR person reports to a CFO? This is the kind of logical consistency. Once you define HR this way, you're going to get that. The problem is, for any of you who've ever reported to a CFO, you understand. The basic accounting equation is what? Assets equals liability plus owner's equity. And HR is one of those positions that straddles both the asset enhancement side, that would be training and development, that would be recruiting, that would be organization development, that we, and then the liability side, which is payroll, ERISA, immigration,
wage,
you know, these are all the risks. So HR straddles it, but once you're reporting to the CFO, you've got a balance towards liability reduction. It's in the function becomes imbalanced, and the people tend to tilt towards looking at the negative side of life, looking at the risk side of things. It just is the way it is. So what's been your experience? Is that how HR is? Does that make sense?
You know, I've seen HR be like a tool. In other words, instead of HR being the protector of the company, like the person who says, look, we have rules, we have policies, there's laws,
right,
and we have to make sure that we enforce them, I've seen HR be sort of just the executor, really. The CFO or the president says, I want to get rid of X, and you say, gee, I don't think that's, you know, have PR consequences and all
right.
These things. Well, I don't care about that. You know, well, I'm gone.
Right.
And the HR, it's supposed to really stand up and say, look, I know you're the president of the company, but this is not, this, I strongly disagree with it. This is not what the company's doing.
I think conceptually one of the really, really bad things that happened to HR was there was a slogan about 10, 15 years ago by the HR should be a business partner. How many of you remember that? Well, the problem was the way it actually got implemented was, okay, you get the junior seat at the table. And HR should be a distinctive voice at the table, not just have a seat at the table. And I think the role, when I think of HR, one of my favorite shows is Star Trek Next Generation. Any of you ever see that? And to me, that's like the idealized version of how business should be run, because you've got Geordi, who's the technical guy. He's the blind guy, you know? And then you've got there's this female who kind of reads people very well. So, and she's from another planet, and she's got a completely different set of skills. And the captain wants both of their opinions and respects the fact that they're different. And it's his job as captain to make the decision. And he values the fact that they're going to come at the same problem from different ways. And that's the way it should be. One of your great contributions, if you choose to accept it, is to help CEOs understand when the dilemmas that they're facing as opposed to the problems that they're facing. To help them understand the larger system-wide issues, because sometimes they get caught into that. It's not to have a seat at the table. It's to have a distinctive voice at the table.
Chris Hedges will also tell you not to crash and burn. Every day you put your job on the line when you are presented with a dilemma and the president feels that there's a mandate that you need to fulfill. And quite frankly, Charlotte, I don't, you know, this is what you need to do. Yeah. Or this is what I'm doing, regardless. So you make them aware of the risk, but at the end of the day, it's their business.
At the end, your job is to make them aware.
And hopefully, yeah.
And then if continually not be aware, you got to do what you got to do for yourself. But your job is to have a distinctive voice, not just have a seat at the table. And
now, you mentioned that was 10 years ago, HR should be a business partner. Do you think that we've changed, we've come a long way since then?
No, I think it's gotten worse.
Yeah. So what's your solution?
Well, first of all, yeah. One is to articulate a new value proposition for HR. Because if you don't articulate it, if you're not forceful about it, nobody else is going to do it. Everybody is still caught up in the 19th, early 20th century version of HR. And this is the 21st century. It's different. What's the new? So, first of all, the idea is we're in the business of attracting, retaining, and motivating employees. No, you're not. That's a problem. You're in the business of attracting, retaining, and motivate anyone who influences customers. Because the traditional way that HR sees employee-centered issues, it excludes 1099s. They're not in the personnel manual. How many 1099s get valued to the 4th of July picnic or to the Christmas party? And yet your client, the customers, they really don't make these fine distinctions between 1099 and W-2s. It's all anyone who's touching them is as far as they're concerned an employee. Interesting enough, a lot of customers are also acting as employees at your bank. You have a lot of customers now doing things that tellers used to do through ATMs. This morning I went to a gas station. I'm doing things that a gas attendant used to do, fill up my car and wipe my, so even customers are doing things that employees used to do. And by God, if they're not happy doing that, if they don't find it a pleasant experience, you're going to lose customers. You know, but your mandate should be to, how do you attract, retain, motivate anyone who touches the customers, not just employees. The other issue, and this is your point, it's the changing nature of power. In the industrial model that HR grew up with, and in the industrial model that I still see in, with a lot of my clients, the assumption is that power flows top down, and it doesn't. And every, this is like, I don't know if you've ever seen Leonard Cohen's, has a wonderful song called Everybody Knows. So his refrain is everybody knows, everybody knows. And everybody knows that's not the case. Power is no longer top down. Power is top down and bottom up. The case that I showed you is a beautiful example of that. You're absolutely right. Thomas is fired. Thomas tweets that he's fired. The other lifeguards tweet that they're fired. It starts circulating, gets picked up by the local TV channel, and then all of a sudden is made a big deal. What's the difference between that and what went on in Egypt? If power was only top down, we wouldn't have all this unrest in the Middle East. It isn't anymore. The power is top down and bottom up. I don't see HR grasping that. HR needs to be more, now what's the practical implication about that? Practical implementation is the natural alignment in the old 19th century model of HR was HR is a handmaiden of the CFO. In this new model, HR is more aligned, probably going to be more aligned with marketing than it is to finance. If it defines itself as we're in the business of attracting, retaining, and motivating everybody who touches the customer experience, then marketing is suddenly interested in what you have to do. The VP of HR at Southwest reports through the marketing function. That's how it should be. Because now you're, now instead of being on the cost side of the basic accounting equation, you move to the asset side of the basic accounting equation by redefining your role from employee-centric to anybody who's touching the customer. Structure of HR. You've taught this probably, Hertzberg, hygiene and versus motivational factors. Canadian guy from McGill University basically said, when we look at what motivates people, there's two things. There's hygiene factors and motivational factors. Hygiene factors would include the lighting and the heating in this room. If the lighting was not here, if the room was cold, I would be thinking of nothing other than that, right? But the fact that the room is lit and the fact the room is nicely heated, I'm not thinking about it anymore. If your employees are underpaid relative to the market and know it, they're not going to think about anything else but that. But if they're adequately paid, they take it for granted. If they don't have health insurance, it bothers them. But if they do, they're going to take it for granted. These are hygiene factors. The absence of a hygiene factor will consume the person, and the presence of it, they'll take it for granted. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So compensation is one. Benefits is another. Health and safety and compliance. These are all hygiene factors. Can any of you think of any others in your companies?
Relatively safe work environment.
Safe, sure, safety. Motivational factors are different. And that is the presence will actually motivate. So organization development, making feel people part of something, people feeling they're part of a team, people feeling good about the mission. Recruitment can be a motivator because, again, in an open systems, you're not just looking for a body, you're also sending a message about the company to the community. Training and development would be motivators as well. So maybe we need a new definition of HR. One is to attract, retain, motivate anyone who touches the customer, not just employees. And how do we measure HR effectiveness? I would argue something like the customer loyalty index. Anybody familiar with that or use that in your companies? A very simple measure that we've used with our clients. And I would recommend this company to a friend or colleague. 0 is never, 10 is always. Pick a number from 0 to 10 and explain why you gave the answer you did. Interesting enough, that one question you could ask employees and you could ask customers. And so the idea is you ask one question of your customers and the same question of your employees, and you're looking at the whole thing as a thread because many of your employees are also customers. That's particularly true at you have a community bank. Your employees are members of the community and they're married and they have relatives and they have extended families in the community who are also your customers. It's an open system, not a closed system. Again, the industrial model says these are employees, these are customers, these are two different things. No, they're not. It's an open system. If anybody want more information about the customer loyalty index, just put it down on your business card. I'll be glad to send it to you. I'll send you an example report. What are the skill sets that I think are needed for HR? One is a very specific ability to look at problems from both sides of the basic accounting sheet, which is what I find is because of the structure of HR today, the default is to look at things from the liability reduction side of things. The problem is the more you do that, the more you will be devalued. It's very similar to attorneys. The difference between a good attorney and a valued advisor to a CEO is a good attorney will focus on here are the risks. A valued advisor to the CEO will show that he can look at both sides of the basic accounting equation, not just look at the risks. Second is open system thinking. And the Hallandale case is a very good example of that. You showed kind of an open systems approach. And again, a lot of HR doesn't. That's a problem. And then finally, you be the chief dilemma officer. Because many of the officers of your company are trained to be problem solvers, don't want to look at dilemmas because it's difficult and complex, and if you don't raise it, who is going to raise it? And again, a dilemma is we're caught between two things. If we do this, the following bad things will happen. On the other hand, if we do this, the following bad things are going to happen. And again, I use the example of Iran. You can go on and on. You can see dilemmas all over the place. And who's the enemy? The enemy is HR. If HR is in a very difficult spot where it doesn't get a lot of recognition, doesn't get a lot of respect, who did that? HR did it to itself. With this stupid concept of the seat at the table. They wanted a seat at the table and had no idea what they're going to do once they got it. So now they have a baby seat at the table. And it needs a distinctive voice. This is what we do. This is how we do it. Don't expect anybody to take care of you, but you. If you don't articulate this, let me tell you how I can be of value to you. If you're not willing to say that, why would you expect a CEO to? And the problem that I find as a recruiter is when I am asked to recruit for HR heads, the CEOs have a model based on what they were trained, and so they're looking for some director level who's going to report to a CFO, because that's what they're used to. What needs to be done? If you're going to survive in this new world, when I was young, I thought learning was really tough. Now that I'm old and stupid, I realize learning is actually pretty easy. It's the unlearning. And the most difficult thing is unlearning what was successful for you in the past. And again, the mantra I would love you to walk out of this room with is to say to your CEO on Monday morning, there's so much more I could do for you. And here's what I could do for you. If you don't say that, nobody's going to. So what are you going to do to help yourself and help your company Monday morning? That's my challenge to you. So let me summarize what we talked about. One, we gave you a case, the Hallandale case. It's a very practical way to illustrate Chris Arger's technique. And again, when we are doing searches, we will create these dilemmas, very short cases. And by the way, once you've created the case, you can use them for training and development purposes as well, so you can recycle them. Hallandale case is nice because everybody sort of understands what a lifeguard does. Mm-hmm. And so they can sort of get it. We have discussed what HR was historically and where it needs to go in a world that has totally changed. You know, the world is different. HR needs to rebrand, it needs to reposition. My sense is some companies are already starting to do it. What they're doing is they have this thing called HR operations, which are basically the Hertzberg hygiene factors, the payroll, health, safety, and benefits. That may be just given to one person. That person could actually report to the CFO and it wouldn't be a problem. And then there's HR, and that's going to be OD, training, recruitment, management, development. That is the more reward system. And that some companies are starting to separate those things out. Any questions? Do I what?
Do you see a lot of those jobs?
No, the answer is at this time and in Boston, I do not. And what I've found to my sorrow is that innovation in human resources travels west to east. Mm. If you want to know what's going to happen in the future, look to Los Angeles. Mm. It's going on now in LA. It will then move to Chicago and New York, and Boston, it will be last. In technology, we're probably, you know, probably ahead of the curve. In HR, we're behind the curve.
Why
I think in general, the Boston is a conservative market. You have this slice called technology, you know, so the life sciences, and on the technical side, they're very innovative. But once you get beyond that, Boston's fairly conservative and pretty insular. When we look at best in class, we tend to look within Boston. And it's, you know, HR in Boston is not best in class. It's not where the really innovation is occurring.
Well, you can be a trendsetter.
All these new nuances in regards to HR-related issues coming out of California. I mean, the employment issues there, or the regs are just...
Well, though, yeah, that is not what I would call... I'm talking about on the OD and management development side rather than the legal and the tax side. No. California is not being a pioneer there. But again, the issue is, I would take the position that your CEOs really don't understand what HR could do. And so you're being underutilized because they've got an old idea. The other thing is you don't even have to tell a CEO, you can just start doing it. The practical thing also is look where your natural allegiances are. Your natural allegiances are with a marketing function, not with a finance function.
I'm in sales, so this is a lot of what's going on in sales right now. We call it sales 2.0. It's not, used to be product-centric. Now it's going to be customer-centric. So it's the same.
Same
thing. And every industry is going through this. And, because everybody's getting so much inundated with, from so many different directions. We talk about social media. It changes. People are starting to become so much more educated about what they can do. They don't, so they're taking a lot more on themselves, and then they need to help make decisions because they don't have all the expertise. So they're bringing, we see people do all this research, and then they come to you at the very end saying they may have their mind, but they need help with the rationalization of this. Is this the best product? And so it's the same thing here. It's just, everybody's going through it. Every industry's going through it. Every function is going through it. So it is, it's fun, it's interesting, it can be depressing, obviously, but it's always like, what's in for me to buy from you is what we're talking about. What's in for me to hire you is probably what you probably have to do. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing, it's just we're talking a different somewhat language because our perspectives are different.
Yeah. I think
you learn to love it.
part of this is it takes courage to be a good HR person, and it's hard. You have to get over the idea of wanting to be liked, and if you're not respected, then it's time to go. But don't even try to be liked. That's not your job.
The person I report to is our head of our strategic planning.
Yep.
Who will be reporting to the president of the bank.
Mm-hmm.
He currently reports to the CEO. But our CEO is trying to retire in place.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been telling us, your customers are not your employees. Your customers is the company. The department heads. And that's, to an HR person, you're supposed to be the advocate for your employees, but he's like trying to drive that to us that your customer is the bank, is the department heads, the company, not your employees.
And
that's what
you're telling. Yeah, I knew a guy named Lou Rambo who was head of HR at Arthur D. Little, and he had the best saying for this. He said, "I'm 51% for the company and I'm 49% for the employees." And once the your job is to confront the CEO and say, "If I do what you ask me to do, here are the consequences." If HR is perceived as only for the bank and not an advocate for the employees, then basically you make us an administrative function, pushing paper. Here's a different way of looking at it. He may accept it. He may not accept it. Your issue is: do you have the courage to confront the CEO? HR is just one of those things where, you know, everybody thinks they could be a great teacher. And everybody thinks they could be a great HR person. But it's harder than it looks, as you know.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. This is, I'm glad we brought you back. You're such
Thank you.
Terrific, thoughtful.
If any of you would like Thank these you. Slides,
yeah, I'd love
just give me your cards and I'll be glad to send
Thank
them to you.
You
and I'll also give you the MP3.
Yeah. Do you have a business card too?
Sure.